Vishvabihari.
Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari. Gopi Channa Palabha Giravarir Hari. Gopi Channa Palabha Giravarir Hari. Yashoda Nandana Vraja Jana Ranjana. Yashoda Nandana Vraja Jana Ranjana. Yamuna Tira Vanachari. Yamuna Tira Vanachari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari.
Jai Om Vishnupad, Paramahamsa Parabrajikatera, Esoterra Sadashi, Shimrit Divine Grace, A.C. Bhakti Vedanta Swami Maharaj, Shri Prabhupada Ki Jai, Samaved Bhakti Vrinda Ki Jai, Gaur Vimananda, all glories to Sema devotees, all glories to Sema devotees, all glories to Sema devotees, all glories to Shri Guru and Shri Guranga. Nama Om Vishnu Karaya, Krishna Pasaya Bhutale, Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Swaminita Namane, Namaste Sarasvati Devam Gauravana Vichara Nenu Vishesha Shunyavali Paskachari Sitarani. Jai Prabhupada. So today we're reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 7, Text 3. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Kridayam Ujumur Bhasya. Kamascha Kridashantyata. Vatas Draptasya Chakatam. Nivritasya Sidanyata. Kridayam Ujumur Bhasya. Kamascha Kridashantyata. Svatastraptasya Chakatang. Nivritasya Sidanyata. Vridayam Ujumorvasya. Kamascha Kridashantyata. Svatastraptasya Chakatang. Nivritasya Sadanyata. Vaishnavis. Kridayam, in the matter of playing, Udyama, enthusiasm, Arbashya, of the boys, Kama, desire, Chakridisha, willingness to play, Anyata, with other boys, Svata, Triptasha, for one who is self-satisfied. Cha, also. Katam, what for? Nivritasya, one who is detached. Sada, at all times. Anyata, otherwise. Translation purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada. Boys were enthusiastic to play with other boys or with various diversions because they are encouraged by desire. But there is no possibility of such a desire for the Lord because he is self-satisfied and detached from everything at all times. Report. Since the Supreme Personality of Godhead is one without a second, there is no possibility that anything besides him can exist. He expands himself by his energies in multi-forms of self-expansion and separated expansions as well, just as fire expands itself by heat and light. Since there is no other existence besides the Lord himself, the Lord's association with anything manifests his association with himself. In Bhagavad Gita 9.4, the Lord says, Maya tatam idam sarvam jagahara vyaktamurtina matstani sarvabhutani nachaham teshvavashtita. The complete manifestation of the cosmic situation is an expansion of the Lord himself in his impersonal feature. All things are situated in him only, yet he is not in them. This is the opulence of the Lord's attachment and detachment. He is attached to everything, yet he is detached from them all. Om Jnanati Prandi Shaganam Jana Salakaya Chaksar Nitanina Tasma Shri Karve Namaha Shri Krishna Chaitanya Kabuna Chananda Shri Veda Garatar Shivasi Dhuvar Bhakta Vinda He Krishna Kuna Sindhu Dina Bandhu Jagatpate Gopisha Gopika Kanta Rara Kanta Namostate Dakta Kanchana Gorange Gare Vrindavaneshwari Vishavanu Sate Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Panchakalpati Vyashya Krita Sindhu Vyavacha Patitano Pavanebhyo Vaishnavegyo Namo Namaha. So in the beginning of this chapter 7 of the third canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, Vaidura asks several questions. And these are very deep questions. They're not just simple things with simple answers. And it's described later that Maitreya seems a little astonished, is the word, or surprised that he's asking these things. But it's not that he doesn't know the answers, of course. He is asking these questions to give the opportunity for Maitreya to illuminate the Vaishnava philosophy. So in yesterday's verse, it was discussed that Krishna is complete and unchangeable, so how does he interact with the modes of nature? Today, the verse is about boys playing due to kama, or desire. Says Krishna cannot have such desire, because kama is material desire. Says he's self-satisfied and detached. So how does this happen? It's not specifically stated, but I assume the implication is, why do we see him play? Because obviously, Vidura was contemporaneous with Krishna. you know, he appeared alongside him and went through all of his different pastimes with the Pandavas, etc. So he's seen him enact all of these different activities in Vrindavan. He's saying, but he can have no desire. He's self-satisfied and detached. And then later we'll see other questions, very wonderful questions that he asks. He asks about the position of the jiva as a pure spirit. If he's pure spirit soul, how can we become covered by Maya? It's a very good question. And the purpose, of course, of all of this is to explain these very essential elements of the philosophy. So in these verses and purports, and especially Srila Prabhupada's purports, are specifically explicating the philosophy of Achintabheda Tattva. That is, the simultaneous, inconceivable oneness and difference of Krishna and his energies. Now, it's interesting, I just recently discovered this, that this term was first enunciated by Jiva Goswami. Now, of course, we know the philosophy is Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's philosophy, but it seems as though he didn't actually use this exact term, Achintabheda Tattva. And that was later developed by Jiva Goswami. In fact, it's specifically used in the Paramatma Sundarbha text 78. You can find him in a long discussion about the oneness and difference and its inconceivable nature. Baladeva Vijayabhushan also talks about it and uses those terms. But of course, then I was wondering, but I'm for sure Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami used those terms, but of course, he was a student of Jiva Goswami's in Vrindavan, so he obviously learned from the Goswami's and used similar terminology to express the philosophy. At any rate, it's a perfect understanding of a perfect philosophy, and I've always been very, very taken by it, about how it so succinctly in four words, however you break it up, the absolute truth. It's rather remarkable, really. So our Vaishnava understanding is that there is nothing in the creation that is different from Krishna. And that's the first point that Prabhupada makes, interestingly, in his purport, where he says, there's no possibility of anything besides him that can exist. In other words, only Krishna exists. It's kind of interesting because so often we hear the opposite, right? Because of Mayavadi influence, and Prabhupada is always trying to combat that everything is one, we usually hear things that, you know, we are different. We are very small, Krishna is very large, you know, our philosophy like that. But in this, here he's taking the other perspective because there are two balanced perspectives here. That Krishna is everything. And when you think about this, how could it be otherwise? How could there be anything that wasn't Krishna? That would mean that there would be something besides Krishna, different from him, greater than him, some cause. Krishna is sarva-karana karanam, the cause of all causes. He's the original person. He's that original form, the original that everything material and spiritual comes from him. So everything has to come from him. But that does not mean that everything is Krishna and everything is simply one, as the Mayavadis would say. So we know that which is created in this material world, this material energy, is also the supreme. And yet, Krishna remains aloof, unchanged, and not part of the creation. Prabhupada used the expressions in his purport, his energies and multiforms of self-expansion and separated expansions. Now, this is talking about these Spamsha expansions and Vibhinangsha expansions, right? In other words, that he has his own personal expansions of his spiritual energy, and he also has his separated, which are not Vishnu Tattva expansions. Of course, the material world, and in between, of course, is the living entity. Living entity is internal potency, spiritual potency, but the Tushta, the Jiva, is subject to become covered by the material energy, so in that middle position. Now, there are two ways that we can understand knowledge. Well, there's only one way we can understand knowledge, but there's two ways that philosophers understand knowledge in the Vedic system. This is called ontology. Yesterday we learned about epistemology, which means the study of knowledge. Ontology is the philosophical study of the nature of being, of existence, of what is reality. So, it's described in Chaitanya Charitamrita. Two theories, in Adilita 7.1.21 and onward, and then again in Majjhalila 6.1.70 onward, there's these two terms used, which are Paranambada and Vivartanambada. Verse 123 of Adi 7. Vastuta parinambara se se praman deha atma buddhi eva vatera stan. Transformation of energy is a proven fact. It is the false bodily conception of the self that is an illusion. So, basically speaking, Paranamavada means the theory of transformation, where Vivartavada is Shankaracharya's Mayavada philosophy, which is the theory of illusion. That says everything is Brahman. Okay, we're with him so far. Everything is spiritual energy, but there are no differences. Any differences that you perceive, you think there's a material world, you think you are a separate personality. Nope, that's illusion. That's Maya. Don't ask them, where does Maya come from? How does the absolute truth get covered by Maya? These things can't be answered. I remember one purport I was reading in the Srimad Bhagavatam by Vishvanatha Chakravarti Thakur. He says, sometimes Vaishnavas find Mayavadi philosophy very difficult to understand. And he says, of course it is. He says, it's impossible to understand because it's ridiculous. it makes no sense. And even the logical progression of it breaks down very quickly. And our acharyas have been quite expert at doing that. But at any rate, the theory that everything is illusion, the Shankaracharya's theory, and the Paranamavada is the theory of transformation. God creates through the world, this material creation that we see, ourselves, everything, through his energies, through his potency. So he is not transformed. Krishna remains one, but his energies transform. It's actually not that difficult of a concept, right? I mean, for devotees, we can see Krishna has so many energies. I mean, there are, of course, his main energies, internal energy, spiritual energy. You can break it down into, Sandini, Samvit, Ladini, so many different energies. They all come from him, so they're not different from him. But they also do act separately, particularly his material energy and prakriti. So the Vaishnava understanding of Chinta Beda Beda Tattva is really the same as the Parinamvada, but a little more developed by Lord Chaitanya. So God is inconceivably both one with everything, and yet he remains separate, unchanged. So the theory of transformation says that the material energy is both real and not real. How is it real? Because it's Krishna's energy. It does exist, although sometimes manifest and sometimes non-manifest. It's unreal because it's temporary, and our attachment to temporary forms is illusion. So that is the illusion of Maya. It's our illusion that Maya covers our intelligence so that we identify with these bodies, these senses, the subtle body, the mind, as the self, forgetting the Atma, forgetting the spiritual self in relationship with Krishna. That's the illusion. Krishna Chakravarti Thakura says, this world cannot be eternal since it was previously not existing and will be destroyed in the future. But it is shown to be real by comparing it to clay and gold, which transforms into pots and gold earrings. So he gives the example of the clay and the pot. The pot is a manifestation of the clay. The pot can be broken, it returns to clay, but the pot was real. That was a real pot you had in your hand, but it's temporary. So our understanding is while things are temporary in the material energy, they do have purpose if they're used in Krishna's service. Therefore, we don't consider it false. We don't consider this material world unreal. In one sense, we do. You can see that, okay, there is a unreality because it's temporary, but to consider it false is actually, Rupa Goswami calls that palgu vairagya. He calls it useless vairagya. In other words, I'm just giving up everything in the material world. I don't care about anything that's here. It's all false. I'm spiritual. No, everything can be used for Krishna's service. So in that way, we transform material to spiritual. Prabhupada's given many examples of that. When the material comes in contact with the spiritual, its utilization becomes spiritual, and therefore it can be considered spiritual, even though it's made of material elements. Okay. Many other examples given probably gives examples of the sun and the sunlight. The sun is the energetic source. The sunlight is energy, depends on that source. It's separate, but yet it's of the same nature. Okay. So Krishna controls material nature, but he remains aloof. Bhagavad Gita says in 7.4, Namay Bina Prakriti Ashtika. This material energy is Krishna's energy, but it is separated. Bina means separated. Separated energy. So it's his, may bina. It's, you know, it's his energy, but that separation means that he is not directly there. And forget if it was Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur's or Shiva Jiva Goswami's purport of today's verse, says the material energy is not his sarup. He doesn't put his spiritual form into the material energy. It's a separated energy, but it's not his pure, you know, original sarup, his original form. Although sometimes he does, doesn't he? In other words, he appears occasionally in this material world in his original form. But that's not material. It's spiritual. He brings his whole spiritual world, his dham with him, his entourage with him. All of the, everything that is spiritual in the spiritual world in Goloka Vrindavan descends with Krishna into this material world. Why? For the benefit of the living entities, so that we can become enlivened by Krishna's wonderful pastimes, we can hear his philosophy, you know, we can become attracted to Krishna once again. And he also enjoys performing pastimes. There's some pastimes he doesn't do so much in the spiritual world, like killing demons, right? So he can come to the material world and have that, you know, enjoy that pastime. So there are things that he enjoys doing it too. But that's the point. He's coming for his own benefit and his own enjoyment, which we will get to that question in a minute with today's verse. But I just wanted to mention Srila Prabhupada quotes in the purport today, a very, very important verse in the Bhagavad Gita 9.4, where Krishna says, by me in my unmanifested form, this entire universe is pervaded. All beings are in me, but I am not in them. And then the next verse, 9.5, says, and yet everything that is created does not rest in me. Behold my mystic opulence. Although I am the maintainer of all living entities, and although I am everywhere, I am not part of this cosmic manifestation, for myself is the very source of creation. So I think we could make a good case that right here in the Bhagavad Gita, we actually have a Chintaveda Veda philosophy. How Krishna is maintaining everything, but yet he is distant. He is everything, but yet he isn't. And he says, behold my mystic opulence. It's a chinta, right? Inconceivable. You know, very difficult to understand. In the purport, Prabhupada says, therefore the Lord says, although they are situated on my inconceivable energy as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, I am aloof from them. This is the inconceivable opulence of the Lord. Now, I think this term achinta is always interesting because you think, well, if I'm at Krishna's one, Krishna's different, why do we have to say achinta? That's inconceivable. And if it is inconceivable, why are we even talking about it and we can't understand it? And, you know, it might raise certain questions like that. So these things are difficult to understand. In one sense, they can't be understood in full, but they can be understood to some degree by Krishna's grace. Krishna, just as it's described in the 11th chapter in the Universal Form, that nobody can see this universal form, but Krishna says to Arjuna, I give you divine eyes to see this. Right? You have that divine eye. In other words, Krishna can give that intelligence. Now, Krishna says, I give them intelligence by which they can come to me. Krishna does not say, my devotees are very intelligent, therefore they can understand me. No, he says, I give them the understanding. I give them the intelligence. So it has to come from Krishna. The material cannot understand the spiritual without the divine intercession of the spiritual coming down and helping us to understand that. Think of the example of Lord Brahma in the Brahma Vimoha Lila. After he had stolen the cows of Krishna, and he returns a year later, and he's trying to find where he put them, because he left them in the cave, but then he sees them all out playing. And then he can't tell. Then he's got a set in the cave of boys and cows and a set out there playing in the pasturing grounds. He can't tell which is which. And then he sees the boys that are there transformed to Vishnu forms. And he sees everyone worshiping those forms throughout the universe. And he sees the cosmos inside of each one of these Vishnu forms. By this point, he's becoming quite bewildered. And this is Achintya. This is an inconceivable power of the Lord. And how can one understand such a display? But, yep, in fact, even Balaram was bewildered. It's great. He's going, wow, what's happening? But then Balaram understood. Because Balaram is also Krishna. He's also the Supreme. So he understood also what he was doing. Now, in today's verse, we're talking about Krishna's play. I thought it was an interesting concept that, you know, to use this term. We're talking about this philosophy. He said, in the mature world, young boys play to a desire for enjoyment. And that desire is the word kama. Kama can be defined in many ways. Sometimes it means lust. Sometimes it means enjoyment. You know, it can be very, very broad, just as desire, material enjoyment. So, Krishna has no desire or need for material enjoyment. It's described that he's Atmarama, he's self-satisfied. So what does that mean? There's an interesting example, told in the Gopaltapani Upanishad. Just kind of interesting. The Gopaltapani Upanishad, the first chapter describes the Gopal mantra, or the 18-syllable mantra, which those of you who chant Gayatri, it's the sixth line? Yeah, sixth line. But at any rate, and describes all of, you know, what that means. But then the second chapter is interesting because it's a discussion between Durvasa Muni and Srimati Radharani. How this happens is Radharani and the gopis go to Krishna. They live with him all night, enjoying pastimes. And they wanted to continue those. They didn't want them to end. They said, how can we get more of what we desire? And Krishna says, oh, we'll go to Durvasa Muni. You know, he'll tell you, you know, and offer something to him. So they had sweet rice and things they were going to go over and take to Durvasa Muni. They said, but he's on the other side of the Yamuna and it's too deep. How will we get over there? And Krishna says, just go to the bank of the Yamuna and say, Krishna is a brahmachari. And the Yamuna will give way. And that's exactly what happened. They said, Krishna Brahmachari, the Yamuna's kind of subsided, or went, you know, it became very shallow so they could easily walk across. And as they're talking with Durvasa Muni, who's really enjoying the sweet rice, and then Durvasa Muni says, oh, when you want to go back, you say the mantra, Durvasa only eats Kusha grass, or Durga grass. They said, okay. So he's eating all the sweet rice, and he only eats Durga grass. We've been with Krishna all night, but he's a brahmachari. And they want him to explain it. Well, then he goes into a very, very long, lengthy explanation, which we will spare you of. But basically, he's saying how both Krishna and the pure Atma have no material desires or no material needs, that everything is enacted on the spiritual platform. So because Krishna fulfills his desires only spiritually, only with his pure devotees, only through his spiritual energy and not through the material energy. He does not enjoy with the material energy. Therefore, he is a brahmachari. He is totally aloof, you know, right? Completely aloof from the material energy. So anyway, that was an interesting explanation of that. One more, I'm going to try to say something about Ramanujacharya too. Here's a nice verse from 6936. So this is Vitrasura, very, very wise demon, great devotee. He says, you were one without a second, and therefore your contradictions like doing and not doing, happiness and distress are not contradictory. Your potency is so great, it can do and undo anything as you like. With the help of that potency, what is impossible for you? And that was actually a short part of the verse, a very long verse. Prabhupada says, we should not be astonished to find contradictions in the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Actually, there are no contradictions. That is the meaning of his being supreme. Because he is all-powerful, he is not subject to the conditioned soul's arguments regarding his existence or non-existence. He is pleased to protect his devotees by killing their enemies. He enjoys both the killing and the protecting. So, anyway, these are very, very nice verses. great explications of our very, very deep philosophy. And we are able to understand this to the degree that we are surrendered to Krishna and that Krishna helps reveal this knowledge to us. It can't really just be through our great intellect or great mind, because basically in Kali Yuga we don't have very great intellects or very great minds. Very limited in that matter, according to the 12th canto. So we have to depend upon the mercy of Guru and the mercy of Krishna. And if one is sincerely hearing and chanting the holy names of the Lord, Krishna gives that understanding. He says, only by undivided devotional service can I be known as I am. Only in this way can you enter into the mysteries of my understanding. Because it is a mystery. To fully understand the Supreme Personality of Godhead is mysterious. But Krishna is saying you can enter into those mysteries, enter into that understanding by the process of devotional service. By simply surrendering to me, not always so simple, but surrendering to me, and particularly because of the mercy of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, just by chanting of the holy name. Okay. So interestingly, Ramanuja, of course, was a great devotee, great Vaishnava devotee in the 11th century, and his philosophy helped also to defeat Mayavadi philosophy. He was very, very strong in that regard, and we know that Lord Chaitanya actually used some of his principles. Lord Chaitanya took the four sampradayas, and he took two principles from each one of them, and for sake of time, Ramanuja says, I'll accept two teachings, the concept of devotional service, unpolluted by karma and jnana, in other words, pure devotional service, and service to the devotees. Those are two very important principles that, of course, we all ascribe to. And then, of course, he took ones from the others, too, and he put them together perfectly as this Acinta-Chinta-Abheda-Bheda philosophy. Now, we know that Shankaracharya had been very, very successful just a couple hundred years before. He had thrown out Buddhism, defeated Buddhism, restored the Vedas. Buddha had thrown out the Vedas because they were being totally misinterpreted and used for animal sacrifice. So Buddha said no, and he taught ahimsa. But then Shankaracharya also developed an impersonal understanding and strongly purported this Mayavada philosophy. And his most important, of course, writings were, what's it called, Sharira Yabhasya, is Vedanta Sutra commentaries. And those were very, very influential, very powerful. So this was what kind of the mood Ramanujacharya was born into in 1017. He was married very early, at 16 years old. His household for quite a few years. They moved to Kanchi, which was a holy city with scholars and many temples. Met a scholar named Yadava Prakash, very renowned for his scholarship, and he was also an Advaita Vedantist, impersonalist. And he would often explain Shankara's commentaries on Vedanta Sutra, but Ramanujacharya, he tried to be respectful, but he just couldn't take it at a certain point, you know, and he sort of showed that he wasn't really agreeing. And so finally, of course, Yadava says, well, all right, you tell me what you think then. And of course, he tells him his philosophy. And Yadava becomes very angry. He says, well, if you like your own interpretation, you think you know better than me, he says, just get out of here and do your own school, basically. So Ramanujacharya did. He formed his own school, which became very popular. And he soon attracted many, many followers because of his wonderful explanation of devotional service and the devotee's relationship with Narayana or Krishna. So, of course, they became a little envious. There was a plot to kill him by the students of Yadava. But he was warned about it, and he escaped and went back to his own school. And by the time they were all off on pilgrimage, by the time they came back, they couldn't understand. They thought he had died because basically his cousin Gopinath was with him, heard of the plot, and he told the others that he'd been killed by a tiger. But meanwhile, he headed back to Kanchi. And so they thought, okay, we better just leave him alone since he escaped this and he must know about it. We'll be very careful. At any rate, became very powerful, very influential. He met Yamunacharya and he took the initiation from Yamunacharya, another great Vaishnav guru. And things went along for a while. Now, eventually, Yamunacharya was at the end of his life and he was about to leave his body. Ramanuja got there just after Yamunacharya had passed away. Now, it's a very interesting story then. Okay, everyone's attention focused on Ramanujacharya as he entered the room and came to sit by the side of his guru, who was had left his body like the day before or something. Tears of love filled his eyes and he wept, his heart feeling great separation from his master. The left hand of Yamuna was posed in a yoga posture for peace, with three fingers extended and the thumb and forefinger joined together, tips something like this, I guess, right? Must be, yeah, like that. Okay. All the disciples were struck. Oh, his right hand, however, was at his side, but clenched into a fist. All the disciples were struck with wonder about the position of the guru's right hand. None of them could understand the meaning. As everyone looked on in wonder, Ramanuja broke the silence by declaring, "Our guru, the revered Yamunacharya, has three desires that he wishes to be fulfilled." He says, "I will protect the people in general who are deluded by impersonalism by bestowing upon them the nectar of surrender at the lotus feet of Narayan." As Ramanuja spoke, one of the fingers on Ramanuja's right hand extended outward. Then Ramanuja said, "For the well-being of the people of the world, I will prepare a commentary of the Vedanta Sutra that will establish the Supreme Person as the ultimate reality." At this, the second finger extended. And Ramanuja continued speaking, "And in order to honor Parashamuni, who in ancient times established the relationship between jivas, living entities, and Ishvara, the Supreme Person, I shall name one of my disciples who is greatly learned and devoted after him." Ramanuja then became silent, and the third finger of the right hand of Yamuna extended. Everyone present was amazed to see this miracle. And from that day on, they all accepted Ramanuja as their leader and guide. Ramanuja continued to live at Sri Rangam for the remainder of his life, and in due course, all three vows were fulfilled by him. Then later, towards the end of his life, he takes sannyas, becomes renounced. Let's see what's down here. There's an interesting story also. I got a couple of minutes. Okay, there was a king whose name was, the press was growing popular. Okay, a group of impersonalists went to see the Chola king, Krimakanta at Kanchi, and they complained about him. And so Ramanujacharya felt he needed to do something. He said the king had in mind to convert Ramanuja by force if necessary. Once he was indoctrinated, he could bring everyone back to the fold of Shankara. After meeting with the king's messengers at Sri Rangam, Ramanuja prepared to go to Kanchi. However, Kuresh, a wise disciple of Ramanuja, did not trust the intentions of the king and pleaded with his guru to allow him to go to his place. Kuresh insisted. Ramanuja had to submit. Then Kuresh dressed in saffron robes of his guru and appeared with the messengers with staff in hand. So they thought he was Ramanuja. When he reached the palace, greeted him with respect, and later, when Kuresh refused to be intimidated by the behavior of the king, in a mad rage, he ordered his soldiers to arrest Kuresh and burn his eyes out. The king's men took Kuresh to prison. After blinding him, released him in the forest. During the entire horrifying experience, Kuresh never once protested. He found strength within knowing that his guru was safe. So in other words, he had sacrificed himself, knowing that Ramanuja would probably be killed or hurt badly by the king. With the help of some people from Kanchi, and the Kuresh was then able to rejoin his guru of Sri Rangam. Within a matter of days, after committing that grave offense against Kuresh, King Krimakrata was stricken with an incurable disease and died a miserable death. So, that's what happens when you cause offense to Vaishnavas. At Sri Rangam, Ramanuja took Kuresh before the deity of Narayan with fervent prayers, asked the deity to restore his sight. "Kindly be merciful and renew the eyes of Kuresh, who without protest had made this supreme sacrifice. At that very moment, Kareesh felt a gentle breeze blow across his brow and immediately regained his sight. So, he lived to 120 years old, Ramanuja, and finally he was ready to leave this world. Ramanuja spoke his last instructions to those most dear and near to him. Always remain in the company of and serve those souls devoted to Godhead, just as you would serve your own spiritual preceptor. Have faith in the teachings of the Vedas and the words of the great saints. Never become the slave of your senses. Always strive to conquer the three great enemies of self-realization, lust, anger, and greed. Worship Narayan and take pleasure in uttering the holy names of God as your only refuge. Serve the devotees of Godhead. By service to the great devotees, the highest service is done, and one quickly gains the supreme mercy. And those were his departing words. And this section ends with, I take refuge at the feet of Sri Ramanuja, our venerable master, who during the dark night of the impersonal conception of divinity, carried the torchlight of knowledge and illuminated the path of devotion to the personality of Godhead. Sri Ramanujacharya ki jai. Okay. Questions, comments?
Thank you for a lucid explanation of the beginning of a series of philosophical explanations in this seventh chapter, and also for your very concise summary of Ramanuja's teaching and his life and his incredible associate that you just mentioned, who got his sight back. My question is kind of getting back to going back to square one. On the one hand, Srila Prabhupada said that if you're not very philosophical, you can understand just chant Hare Krishna and you can go that way. But if you're interested in understanding by some philosophical, we have volumes of books, and you can do it that way. And also there was a kind of a warning in the sixth canto that the Yamadutas were able to give some good answer to the Vishnu Dutas, where they said, you know what religion is? He said, yeah, religion is what's in the Vedas. We heard this from our guru, Yamaraj. Pretty good. Then in that context, in the purport, Srila Prabhupada would kind of warn us that we should be prepared to defeat not only impersonalism, well, that's the underlying undertow, we can say, but we should be prepared to take on adversaries from, you know, philosophical, who have other understandings or misunderstandings, what to speak of the atheists and like that. So for the rank and file members of the ISKCON Society, is it okay if we just try to just chant Hare Krishna and not worry about all these very rather complex and, in one sense, fascinating philosophical implications? Or is it really that, sometimes I think Babinja Saruprabhu was talking about this two-tier religion, the charismatic lower tier where, you know, this jump and shout and kind of thing. And then there's the upper tier, where there's the clergy or the ones that actually study the scriptures and are able to not only give sermons but give some sort of theological understanding. So I don't know, my sense of it is that we need to have more devotees going more deeply into the philosophy. I'm wondering what your take is on this.
I didn't disagree with anything you said. I think both things are there. According to our philosophy, the most critical thing is devotion. And we have so many examples, Kulavecha Shekhar, you know, the illiterate Brahmin in South India, people who were not great scholars, but because of their great devotion, they very much pleased Krishna, pleased Lord Chaitanya. On the other hand, Lord Chaitanya also encouraged, you know, Rupa and Sanatana Goswami to expound on, you know, this philosophy, Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, etc. And we have a very, very wonderful, rich history. People like Jiva Goswami in the Sandarvas, of deep philosophical understanding and very complex, sometimes, understandings of the absolute truth. And our acharyas can, you know, go to head to head with anybody philosophically, basically, you know, and it would probably defeat them. On the other hand, some of us aren't so philosophical, so, you know, we do the service that we can do, we chant nicely, and we try to serve the devotees. So I would say, if you have a propensity, then don't waste it, you know, with mundane knowledge, but try to use it, you know, to really understand the philosophy, to be able to present the philosophy, perhaps to write, you know, all sorts of intellectual endeavors are very much needed, and Prabhupada encouraged those greatly. He encouraged the Bhaktivedanta Institute, you know, devotees to who were scientifically minded, and so many others. So I just think it's a question of whatever your propensities are, to try to utilize those in the best way. You know.
Yeah, thank you. As you're answering my question, I was thinking of Bhagavad Gita 13:26, Anyetve Vama Jananta Shutvaneva Upashati, Te Pichati Tarantyeva Mrityu Shruti Parayana. And he says, there are others who are not philosophically inclined, who, but because of their tendency to hear from authority, they also transcend the their Shruti Parayana, they're liberated by hearing. Because they're tenant, just because they have this tendency to hear from authorities. Thank you.
Yeah, and sometimes you see devotees who are not so perhaps intellectual or philosophically inclined often have very deep faith, you know, and I think that is really important, you know. I mean, at least if faith is there, if one has faith in the word, I mean, we've all had experience when I was a younger, well, I still don't, but, you know, even less so when I was younger devoted, so many things I didn't understand, but I had faith, you know, these were Prabhupada's words, they must be true, and then hoping someday, pray someday that I'll be able to understand more fully. And I think that's important, you know, because we're all really on a continuum, and it's really a continuum of purification to the point of being able to surrender to Krishna, and however we do that. It's a good question. Thank you, Maharaj. I appreciate that. Okay.
This is a very interesting concept that I think many times in my mind also I think about it. But then Prabhupada in one lecture he said, we should chant so the other can participate and come, and then when they advance further, they will be interested in the philosophy. Mm-hmm. And then they progress further, then they will chant purely. So Prabhupada didn't say exactly the way I thought, but I'm understanding that, okay, they will chant, but in order to advance, they have to understand the philosophy, and then the pure name will come.
I mean, there's a reason Prabhupada had us, you know, listen to classes every day. The reason that he wrote and translated books and wanted us to read those books, he certainly wanted us to become philosophically astute to some degree. I guess we have to always remember that that the other side of it. If a person isn't so inclined, simply chant, serve, and advance in that way. But as you said, that also opens up one's intelligence to some degree, spiritual intelligence, to be able to understand the philosophy more, the more one hears and chants. So it's reciprocal. Yeah.
But isn't religion without philosophy
same intelligence?
There you go.
Yeah.
So it has to be both.
All right. Steve T.D. Mooney?
Philosophy without religion is
mental
goes nowhere.
No, it's mental state.
That goes nowhere.
Yeah.
I mean, it just stays within the conditional realm. You don't get beyond the conditional realm.
It's a book.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's not that we chant so that we can understand the philosophy. You know, It's like we chant, we understand the philosophy, then we chant even better.
Right.
You know, it's not that the chanting is the means and the end, but yet we engage the intellect. It's a tool. The human intellect's very special and it facilitates the chanting.
But Krishna says in 10.24.6, I remember, Gyatta Gyatta Chakarmani Janaya Manatishtati Vidusha Karma Siddhishe Avidusha.
Okay.
Gyatta Gyatta Chakarmani. So if someone knows what they're doing and why they're doing, they will get full result. Vidusha Karma Siddhi. They will get success, or Siddhi means perfection. But if someone does not, they will not get. Krishna says directly like that. So, I'm not saying, you know, remembering the slokas or something, but we have to understand why we do things we do, and what will happen.
That's vijnana, right? Realized knowledge. The difference between, you know, someone who might be very intellectual and have so much, you know, philosophical or say intellectual understanding, and vijnana or realization, where one deeply understands that philosophy. So that's what we really want. We want to be able to understand the philosophy, and not so much to necessarily be able to. Well, there is also that, which I think you said, I think, or Maharaj said, that also sometimes we do confront people who are misleading, philosophically, scientifically, whatever, misleading people, and we need to be able to confront that, to some degree, defeat them. Now, maybe not everybody can do that, but I think, as Maharaj was saying, it's good if we have a few devotees who can, you know, like Prabhupada would, right? Prabhupada could speak with anybody, and usually they ended up slinking away, you know, unless they agreed with it.
But it's also, you know, like we focus a lot on 434, that everybody should accept Guru. Guru should be Gyanavan, yes, and then disciples should have Pranipat, Pariprasna, Sevaya, and serve and surrender. No. But this verse, it says, Tad Vidhi, for them, for who? The previous verse, it says, Sreyan, Sreyan Brahma Maya Jyogya, Gyana Jyogya Vyavasthi. So, the one who understands that the rituals or all these activities, it has to lead to or complete with the complete understanding. Not just by doing the rituals automatically you will go.
Not doing rituals, no. No, it has to actually be bhakti.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. All right. I'll go to Srila Prabhupada. Thank you all.
You love your kind of heart in that how rituals. You love something.